You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 340. Back to Punk News Podcast number 340, the podcast that is anarcho, that's crazy, no planning, no script, too hot for TV, raw, wild, uncensored, uncut Punk News Podcast, where we only get raw, dirty, fresh, and as they say in Italy, oui, that's France.
I knew you were going nowhere with that. Usually you have a plan and your plan is amazing, but I can tell right at the start of that.
Our first train wreck comes at 2 minutes and 9 seconds.
I was crashing and burning. Listen, that's the thrill of my spiraling unplanned openings, in that will I or will I not make it? And Adam White, before the podcast, was talking about, he went to this podcast festival, and basically people were talking about how they have scripts and stuff. And Adam White was like, well, we just don't have scripts. And because Adam was like, oh yeah, like he was being kind of a gangster at the podcast festival, and so that's what the Punk News Podcast is like. We have no script, so will we crash and burn, or will we make gold out of coal? Only time will tell. And this time
I'm sure our regular listeners are shocked to learn that we operate without a script.
What if these
are all coming off the top of our head? All this comedy.
What,
gold.
What if we really did have like a script, and this is what we wound up? Listen, that guy talking, that's Tom Trauma. He writes reviews. He's kind of the harder heavy metal, harder punk, harder hardcore kind of guy at punknews.org. Tom Trauma, what's happening this week? What's happening?
Nothing, man. What's happening with you guys? Just, you know, another week another in week life.
Well, let me tell you, all you people that are waiting for the Punk News mixtape, very, very soon. Very, 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 very soon. I did not abscond with your money and buy crack cocaine like a musician that had a scam. No, in fact, I jumped many hurdles, and the mixtape will be in your hands, perhaps by the time you hear this. Also with us, the Chiefy Weefy, the Big Boss Man, Adam White, who just got back from Podcast Mania 2017. Adam White,
Podcast,
how was Podcast Mania? Where there's flames, where there's smoke machines, where there's booth babes?
No, not at all. That's the point. When you go to some like unorganized, you know, put together by the community conference, there are probably for better and not for worse, no booth babes. So I don't know. I've never been to things where there are booth babes. Like, I've been to a lot of conferences, but my conferences must be really dorky and horrible / really enlightened and progressive, because there has never been booth babes. There's always been like, you know, other fat nerds who are talking to me as a fat nerd about fat nerd stuff. And every once in a while, someone gives me a t-shirt.
Well, there's always that.
Yeah.
Well,
which is like, which honestly, like, is that,
you know, booth babes might be overrated at something this like specific. I used to go every year around the year 2000. I went for like 5 years in a row to Milwaukee Metal Fest. It was like this huge metal thing, and there was all these booths, and you know, you could buy every like weird metal bootleg, but like they would have the booth babes, if there were any, would be like adult film stars, and the interaction between the metalheads and the adult film stars was so bizarre that it would have been better if they would have stayed home.
You know what's interesting is I actually went to the booth babe convention last week, the convention for booth babes. And the booth babes they had there were 45-year-old guys in dungarees, surprisingly. So,
is that a shot at me? No,
it was not, but it's interesting that you took it that way. Listen,
I'm not 45.
Speaking of 45-year-old guys in dungarees, Tom Trauma, you went to see Dropkick Murphys last week or something,
I've never
seen Dropkick Murphys, and I very well maybe never will see Dropkick Murphys. But I was surprised in your review. You said that the people there were kind of like people dressed up for a night out at a nice restaurant. That is not what I would imagine a Dropkick Murphys fan base to be.
It was I would say the crowd was more well-heeled than I expected. I've seen them a bunch of times over the years, and this is at a new club. And if you actually read the review, it says that my main curiosity was actually the new club, because I'm like, there's not going to be any punk shows at this club. So if I want to go check it out, this might be the closest thing to what I want to see. Meanwhile, this thing is booked up with tons of cool shows, actually, metal and punk and whatnot. But anyway, but yeah, everybody was wearing like button-up shirts.
Was it like frat boys?
You know, there was some of that. You know, in my previous experiences seeing a Dropkick Murphys, I would describe the crowd as the same as Five Finger Death Punch, but every eighth guy's wearing a kilt. That's how I would traditionally describe the Dropkick Murphys crowd. But this was like the downtown, like young and wealthy going out crowd.
You mean like financial investor types?
No, just like, you know, like, you know, if you have like a you're like your city center. I don't know. I know you're not much of a go out, drink socially kind of guy, John, but like you're any downtown, like a big city, like Toronto.
I've been downtown, Philadelphia. Tom.
But you know what I'm saying? Well, there's like young people that are nicely dressed, yeah, that look like they make more money.
You just mean
you.
normal people you know, that don't.
People who don't only, are just people wearing, who don't only wear denim and patches. Yeah.
Yeah, you mean people with like shirts and pants and jobs and haircuts. Yes.
You know, okay. Well, the funny thing, quite honestly, my buddy, I got one buddy I go to almost probably 80% of the shows I go with the same guy. And we brought our wives. And quite frankly, our wives were like sort of among that group, you know, like dressed better than we were. And, you know. Sort of,
well, you know, like what I mean, if you think about it, it might not be too surprising. I mean, like Dropkick Murphys isn't probably a cheap ticket. Like, they're a big enough band.
The cheap tickets were the floor, believe it or not, which I know it seems like a lot of places now they jack up the floor tickets, but the cheap tickets were the floor, and they were $32.50, and if you wanted to sit up in the balcony further away, it was around $45. But if you're down that crowd, it might have been worth an extra $13, quite frankly. But what killed me was that the beers were $11 for a draft beer.
Man.
And as a guy who works very hard for his money, well, not always, usually works very hard for his money, $11 for beer, I'm like, screw that. I'm like, I'm a married guy with kids. I'm like, I get a halfway decent allowance, but I'm like, man, if I had like four beers, my allowance would be gone. Like, screw that. So, you know.
That is, and I don't want to sound like an alcoholic here, but that is like the most... like the most soul destroying thing, and you know it. You know it's coming a lot of the time, but then once you experience the insane beer prices at something, then you're just like oh, well, fuck, well, like the universe sucks.
It's like the $10 mark for me, man. It's like if I can buy, even if it was $9, and I could buy it and give her a generous, you know, 10%
to 90 cents,
$1. I'm saying if I could buy, if I could have got it for $10 with the tip or something, I don't know. That's just like, that's where my line is.
My wife and I went
after, that's it.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing. My wife and I went to a Jays game this summer and like we went out and I grabbed like a couple cans of beer and I walked back and I'm like, I think I just paid $22, yes, for something. Like, God forbid, Jesus,
you
Christ.
Use your debit card and then you get the bill the next day and you're just like, wow.
Yeah. And it's like we're going to nurse these beers for as much of a Major League Baseball game as we well, possibly
those
can.
Are, those are what you call, and I know John's not much of a drinker, but those are what you call your maintenance beers. You like have six just outside the gate, and then you go in there and you drink like two of the $10 beers for like hours each, and then you get back out and
when I used to see Slayer in the 90s, they would have booth girls, booth babes. Except they weren't in a booth.
Oh,
they walk around with Jaeger shots medicine pill things or beakers, and they'd be like $12 each. And these rednecks with like the Scott, like with the shaved head and the Scott Ian beard, they'd run up and say, "I'll take six shots," and the girl would be like, "That's $48," and he'd give her like $60, and he'd just slam all six shots right there and just go fight another.
The bald head and the Scott Ian beard. Once again, John, I feel like you're picking on me today. You're lucky you're not within arm's reach. I'm sitting here wearing my coveralls. With my shaved head. And my
I love you, Tom. Listen, speaking of confusing times, I believe Adam White recently had a confusing time in the shower. Is that not true, Adam?
Oh, John, discover I did. His so, as, so I maybe. So, John, as I was want to do, I was thinking about you and your problems as I was bathing this morning.
Gotta love a story that starts with Adam was thinking about John in the shower. This never happens to me.
I could try to spin this in any which way, but really, if you boil it down to it, I was trying to think about John in the shower, so I'm just going to own it. Yesterday night, I read the... I was poking around on Pitchfork for some reason, which isn't something I normally do because I'm just not in the habit of it. And I was rifling through their list of reviews. Why was I on Pitchfork? This doesn't matter to the story at all. I was trying to see if they reviewed the new Piss Jeans record, which is amazing. So I'm going through the reviews on there, and I see that, oh, so someone on Pitchfork has reviewed the Menzingers record that came out. So that might be good for a laugh. I'm going to go see what's going on here. So I pop in there, and lo and behold, the guy that reviewed is a guy named Ian Cohen, who's a guy from Toronto that's done a bunch of stuff for various places up here. And Ian's a good egg.
Really?
I like him. So
he's the guy that bashed Ceremony viciously, I think.
Is he? Maybe I'm thinking of the wrong guy.
Like, he's kind of known as being kind of like the jerk, unless I'm confused. Let me look it up real quick.
No, sorry. I'm totally conflating him with someone else. He is not the guy that I think he is. Anyways, okay, so, no, he's from Kentucky. Never mind, he's not from Toronto. Anyways, okay, he has a very similar name to someone who writes for Exclaim, but it doesn't matter. So I'm reading Ian Cohen's review of the Menzingers, and he mentions, John, a lot of the things that you would hold up as, like, a criticism of what we have, like, affectionately called Whiskey and Friendship on this podcast. And, you know, that so many of these songs are written trying to hit like a certain nostalgia core within like 30-year-old people, that there's, you know, that are very purposefully written anthems that are on there that are trying to like be these sing-along, shout-along things. And the one thing that Ian in his review mentions, and it's been ringing in my head for the whole day since, is he makes mention that these songs are very much written with the jukebox in mind. Like, they're songs that you know, that you're in a bar with a bunch of friends, and that, like, you want to put one of these on because you want people to sing along with you, right? And on the one hand, sure, that's true. But on the other hand, I started using that as a measuring stick, and looking at various bands and various things and figuring out, is this something that I could see someone throwing on in a jukebox, or is it not? And that, to me, defines perfectly the divide between this more dangerous, this more weird, this more esoteric end of punk rock that you champion, and sort of the other end of it that you've derided so that people get mad at you, but that we have maybe taken a critical eye on this podcast, I'll say. And I'm going through and I'm looking, and I was thinking about, like, the kinds of music that I was in at various stages in my life. And I can definitely feel like there's like a rhythm where at certain points, I'm into a lot of stuff that I could totally see being on a jukebox somewhere. And then at a certain point, I'm onto things that wouldn't make any sense. Like, if you put it on a jukebox, people would get mad at you, either because it's too abrasive or too weird, or even too quiet, or just not bar music, not fun music, right? And I'm looking at my various lists of, and I sat down and I scratched together a list about, like, you know, when I was in early high school, what was the stuff I was listening to? When I was in early college, what was the stuff I was listening to? And to me, whenever I had an active social circle, when I was going out with friends and doing stuff, I was listening to more stuff that I would attach the jukebox label to. And whenever I was, I don't want to say like more like isolated, but just like not attending, say, musical events with people, going to shows by myself, you know, going and buying a lot of records and then, you know, listening to them, you know, by myself and not in like a party situation or anything like that. Everything starts to go into this non-jukebox territory. So I'm in high school and I'm listening and I'm doing dumb stuff with my friends, and we're driving around in cars and we're, you know, going out late at night and everything, and we're listening to like Less Than Jake and Real Big Fish and Blink 182 and Green Day and all this stuff then, right? So it's all this jukebox stuff. And then privately, I'm getting into Bad Religion and I'm getting into the Sex Pistols and things that I wouldn't normally say put on in jukebox. Early college, we're going out and we're doing like the most of our, like, you know, dumb college freshman drinking, and we're listening to tons of the Slackers, and we're going to all these ska shows, and again, like, jukeboxy kind of stuff. And then as that kind of scene died away, I'm listening to Television, like, like still ska, but like early Trojan ska stuff and Black Flag and getting into hardcore and all of this. And I feel that like whenever I'm in a group, then it's tending towards this stuff that is the jukebox punk. And whenever it's just me, it drifts to the weirder stuff. So like, I don't know what you call the one side or the other. It's like the one side is like the camaraderie side. That's like, that's the jukebox side. And the other side is, I don't know. Like I want to say the catharsis side, but that sounds like it makes it too emo. And that, I think that's what I'm going for here. But the lone wolf side, whatever you would call it. Right. But I'm looking at like even the friends that I've got and what the things that they're talking about right now. And I'm thinking like, I'm like, it almost seems like it lines up with how I assume people's lives work. So I look at like certain current and former punk news people on say Facebook that are really, really super into like the Menzingers and Against Me and everything right now. And they're posting pictures of them at shows and they're with these big groups of friends and they're just having like a great time. And they are just totally in love with these songs and everything. And I'm like, well, yeah, like it fits in that way because they're in these social circles, like they're with groups of friends and going out and like and doing that kind of thing. And then I look at myself and like, so I go and I listen to like the, like say the new Menzingers record and I go like, oh, like I like this, it's good. But then like I drift away and I go and I listen to something weird. And I wonder if it's because I don't have that outlet where like me and a bunch of buddies are going to go scream along to it together. And then I think about you, John. So you're in your mid 30s. You are a lawyer, right? A person in the legal profession. Yeah, I don't know if indeed. I'm allowed to say that. Right. So I get to imagine that the rest of your lawyer dudes, you're not necessarily sitting around talking about music and going to shows together.
Most lawyers really don't even understand the concept of going to a show. You know what I mean? Like I don't really talk about it with lawyers that I work with too much.
Maybe drop your like,
they don't understand. They generally see going to a concert as basically a place where you go and drink and hang out with your friends, not a place where you go to see an interesting band perform. If that makes sense.
Right. So it's probably not jumping to too much of an assumption to make these to say that like the John Gentile music experience is very much between John Gentile and the music.
It is.
You don't have a whole ton of extra people involved. And I am, you know, in that boat too, just because like, you know, I'm a person in my mid 30s. The people that I went to a lot of shows with, you know, they don't live here anymore. And, you know, if I'm going to go to a show, chances are I'm probably going to go to the show by myself. And like, I'll see people there who I recognize or know as acquaintances or anything like that. But like, we're not going to go and like, you know, stand in some big obnoxious row with our arms around each other's shoulders, swaying back and forth as we sing along with a Bouncing Souls song. God. Right.
Thank God like, you're not going to do that, Adam.
So I think I see so much stuff falling on. Into this, if it's in the jukebox zone, it's because your primary like vector for experiencing that punk rock is like with a crowd and with friends. And if you're some, you know, weirdo on the internet that's listening to Bad Canoes, it's probably just like a you thing and not, you know, not something that you're involving like a whole social circle in. So I have no idea what my point is here, but I went through and I read that thing and I just saw like Ian Cohen mentioned jukebox and I'm like that's a really good, that's a good yardstick where I can, and I feel that most things fall onto one side or the other side of it. And I was doing a little bit of like the Tom Trauma hardcore or not thing in my head. Where I'm like, you know, is this jukebox or is it not? And I'm not trying to use jukebox as like a pejorative or anything too, because I take a band that I like say like The Clash, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I could totally put them on the jukebox end of things, right? Not always, but you know, a lot of the time. And it seems pretty comprehensive. I feel like I can cut most bands onto one side or the other of that. And it seems like when you look at, say, like what the crowd on punk news is into, a lot of the times it's like they want the jukebox stuff. Like that's what we've called orgcore, I think, for so long. I think I'm onto something. I'm not sure. This is my unified field theory of punk rock.
You should write it down in like a rambling 55,000 word thesis or something.
I could live in
a
medium.
Live in a dirty shack in the woods of Canada and write your.
But like, am I totally at the lunch?
I totally get what you're saying. Like, if I'm hanging out at the bar with the guys, something we'll listen to something like a NoFX or a Dropkick Murphys or something that I'll call mainstream punk. You know what I mean? Like, nobody wants me to freaking go online and dig up some like Today Is the Day song where it sounds like you're smashing your face into a piano. You know, everybody wants something that's. I totally get what you're saying,
Adam.
But the truth of the matter is, if you really want to go to the bar and you want to listen to a great sing along song, you should play the greatest Canadian song of all time, and that is
Adam. Fight by Night by Rush.
Oh wow!
No, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald by Gordon Lightfoot.
Oh,
that's like the greatest like bar jukebox song ever. I mean, screw
them. Oh my god! Screw them. Screw the Menzingers.
Screw the Menzingers, dude. Put $10 in and just play that all night long.
You want to talk about Gordon Lightfoot? I've got it. Like, I have the.
Do I ever?
Gord's gold. I have Gord's gold on vinyl. I can see it from here. Oh, we can talk about like the Canadian Railroad trilogy and oh man,
dude, don't get too deep for me. I mean, beyond like the three like American hits, I'm pretty
Welcome back to the Gordon Lightfoot podcast, Adam. I think you really are onto something, and I think you've advanced a theory that you proposed once before, and that punk can be one of two things. Generally speaking, it can be the place where I don't fit in. I want a group of friends where we all like the same things, so I feel some comfort. Or punk rock can be the place of freedom and destruction, and I can do what I want to do. And I kind of think that fits in with your jukebox, non-jukebox theory.
Ah, okay, but here, this is why I wanted to bring it up, because this was the question, because I guess when I say it all now, it seems super obvious to me, like, of course. But this is what I wanted to ask, is that do we, as quote-unquote music critics, and I use that so loosely because I don't consider myself a music critic, but as people that other people seem to listen to talk about music, do we judge something on the merits of not being a jukebox thing or being a jukebox thing? Like do we use that as part of our judgment on it? So if I'm looking at, say, like, so I'm looking at Ian Cohen's review of Menzingers there, which he gave it like a 6 point something, which is, I don't know what that, like, that's a pitchfork thing where it's like, we don't hate this, but we're not going to praise it too much. Kind of score, I guess, from the pitchfork world. Like, we're not going to brutalize it, but
it's,
we're going to try
it's
to
the Punk News 3.5 stars.
Yeah. All right. So they gave it a Punk News 3.5 stars. And a lot of his criticism,
really, a Punk News 3.5 stars actually should be a very good record.
Yeah.
Three stars is an okay record.
Three stars. Yeah.
All right. This doesn't matter. Like, so do you say, take a record like the Menzingers, and do you say that this is, you know, that I dislike this for reasons X, Y, and Z, and those reasons are really stating like that this is a jukebox record and that's not what I consider punk rock? Like, is that a valid read on it, or should you go and say, you know what, it's trying to be one of these like camaraderie jukebox punk records, and therefore on the merits of it being that, it's a pretty good one? Like do you use that definition as just like a taxonomy, or you can say like it's in this category and I'm going to talk about it in that way? Or do you use it as like a hammer and you say that, you know what, I don't like this because it falls on that side?
I think the appropriate thing to do is, well, first of all, reviewing a record is complete bullshit no matter who's doing it. All reviews, or most reviews, seek to appear as though they're objective. There is no such thing as an objective music review. It's literally impossible. However, if you're just listening to it as a fan, then it's subjective. So if you don't like jukebox music, then use it as the hammer. But if you're approaching it as a music, quote, critic, what you should be doing is try to be reviewing it as objectively as possible within reason. And therefore, you should ask yourself, what is it that the artist is trying to do? Not what do I want the artist to do, but what is the artist trying to do? Do they excel at it? Do they exceed at it? And if so, is what they are trying to exceed at something worth exceeding at? For example, Falling in Reverse. They're very good at being Falling in Reverse. Or Attila, that's even a better example. Attila is very good at being Attila, a bunch of white boys that use outdated hip-hop lingo from the 80s and rap to death metal beats. They're good at it, but is that worth doing? The answer is no. by contrast. Oh, go ahead.
So is being a jukebox punk band, a crowd pleasing punk band, worth doing?
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know what I've done.
To your first question, I think you have to. You know, I'm not into the Menzingers. It's not my thing. I don't have anything bad to say about the Menzingers. They're not. You know.
Yeah.
It's not going to shock you to know that that's not my thing. But if I were to review it, I guess I would have to hold it up against bands of that ilk that I like maybe a Bouncing Souls or something. I mean, I'd have to use something as a reference point. You know. So ultimately, yeah,
Just in case it goes further than the listenership of this podcast, I actually like that Menzingers record. Like, I have no problem with it. So they're just the example in this discussion. Just because
I have no problem with it either, but I haven't listened to it. I don't plan to.
Also, I've also solved my earlier flub here. I was conflating Ian Cohen, the Pitchfork writer, with Ian Gormley, who is the pop and rock editor at Exclaim. So there you go. Ian's
not with Ian Hunter, the old time singer, or Ian Fleming, the guy who wrote the
Adam White hates Ian Hunter because he's Mott the Hoople, and as we all know, Adam White has a vengeance hatred towards Mott the Hoople.
I didn't know that, but that doesn't surprise
me. That's a really old podcast callback. At some point,
Canadians are known for their vindictiveness.
A couple years ago, we were really on a Mott the Hoople thing.
That's because I started talking about Mott the Hoople. And
you know what? I think I do remember that. I think I was around in those days.
We're already into the podcast. Let's skip mail this week and reach the podcast at punknews.org. And let's play a song. And Adam, what I would say that was quite insightful and has given me a lot to think about.
Yeah, that's what I shoot for. So the next podcast next week, whatever I happen to think about in the shower the morning before, we're going to talk about.
I hope you think about me, Adam, but hey, whatever. Whatever you want to think about.
It's just going to be, you know, roll the dice, I guess, on that one. So here's a song. This is from a band from Halifax, Nova Scotia called Crossed Wires. The song is called Cornered. It is from an EP they released in 2016 called False Spring. This is a three-piece pop punk band, but there's a lot of distortion and guitar noise and cool stuff that's going on behind them being a pop punk band. They're playing a couple shows right now that are being promoted by the Ottawa Explosion people, so they would probably, I'm going to assume, show up there this year. I mean, they showed up there in 2016. So anyways, this is Crossed Wires with the song Cornered.
You got them all fooled.
And we are back, and that was Crossed Wires doing Cornered. Let's start off with just a fun little tidbit, if you will. In 2012, Epitaph Records released a very limited press Joe Strummer Mescalero's live record, live at the Action Town Hall, November 15, 2002. And it was a pretty cool record. It was about half non-class jams, half class jams, double LP. And the last three tracks were Joe Strummer and Mick Jones joining Joe Strummer on stage, I think for the first time since the Clash broke up. And they did three Clash tunes. They did a White Riot. They did a Bank Robber, I believe, and one other tune. I forget the other one. Anyway, it's a great live record. It's actually been out of print since then. I was lucky enough to snag one up at Rasputin Records for some reason in 2000. Not Rasputin, Amoeba Records in 2012. But it's back. Epitaph Records, who really owns Hellcat Records, they're going to re-release it for a very reasonable $18 double LP set of Joe Strummer live at Action Town Hall. Fantastic live record. I just think this is cool, and I think people should check this record out. One of the things that people are frustrated with Joe Strummer, perhaps, is he got a little mellower after the Clash, and maybe he didn't do that fiery renditions of Clash tunes. On this record, it's not probably quite as fiery as Clash self-titled Through London Calling, but they are excellent takes, and it's an excellent live record. Tom or Adam, have you guys heard this record?
I haven't, but I certainly would like to check it out.
It's real good. It's real good.
I feel like I've seen clips from this on online or over the years, so it'd be nice to actually get it in hand. I was a huge fan of the Mescaleros while they were around. Global Agogo is one of my favorite records. So the I'm cool with the with Joe Strummer being kind of like the wizened old world music weirdo. He wore that well. I thought it was a cool persona for him.
It was convincing, and it spun the angle of Joe Strummer kind of giving the audience what they wanted without him purely pandering to the audience, which of course we talk about on the Black Flag special, which may be out by the time you hear this, may not be. So Joe,
hey, look at this. I reviewed Global Agogo on July 27th, 2001.
Nice.
Christ.
Yeah, before the world
that's
changed.
A long time ago. I mean, what I liked about his the direction that he was at was with the direction that the Mescaleros went in was that it didn't seem like the easy thing that that a lot of old frontmen of bands do these days. Like, it wasn't one guy and an acoustic guitar playing folk songs. It was really an extension of the kind of stuff that Joe was trying to promote on the radio show that he had at the time, which I think was just called London Calling, which is a BBC show that he had, where he was just like trying to find as much like far out weird world music that he could and championing this stuff. So then the band that he puts together, like a lot of those influences were reflected in it. So it's one of those things where like, yeah, it may not have been a punk rock, but like, at least it was an ethos kind of where like at least he was trying something, and like there was an artistic bent to it and an arc that he was on. And it wasn't just like him being, hey, it's me, Joe Strummer. I'm going to bang out some songs because you're going to buy them.
Probably the biggest musical regret I have is not going to see Joe Strummer when I had the chance to see him on his last or second to last tour.
You're man. He was in Toronto signing something at a Sunrise Records or an HMV or a Sam the Record Man or one of those Toronto places that was open at the time. And for whatever dumb shit reason that I had, I was like, oh, I'm not driving to Toronto. It's going to take like an hour and 40 minutes. And then he died soon after that. And I felt horrible. I was like,
oh, I'm not driving to Philadelphia. See Joe Strummer. He's not even going to do that many Clash songs. And of course he did. And he died. So, as we always say, see him while you can, see him while you can. I don't think we can overstate that. And speaking of seeing while you can, the Dead Milkmen, they're going to release a new EP. The new EP is going to be called As the World Self-Destructs, End of the World, it's going to be called. It's going to be out on the Giving Grove Records, which is a new record label. And half the money is going to be donated to a nonprofit called Girls Rock Philly, which I think teaches young women how to play instruments and how to have a good time playing instruments. Dead Milkmen are clearly the most famous punk band to come from Philadelphia, but they never seem to be quite placed on the same level as the Dead Kennedys, as Black Flag, as the Ramones. And so the question is it because they lasted longer than those bands and had a chance to put out some mediocre records, whereas, you know, Dead Kennedys broke up pretty quickly, Black Flag broke up relatively quickly, Dead Milkmen were around for at least 20 years before breaking up initially and then came back again. Or are they not as hallowed because they simply aren't as good? A lot of people have different opinions on that. And also, are you guys excited for this EP?
I have loved the last two Dead Milkmen full lengths.
Last one was real good.
I think the reason they're not as big is because, one, there weren't an angry political band like pretty much the rest of those bands you mentioned. And also, I think their humor is too smart for a lot of people, quite honestly. I don't think people realize how clever a lot of their lyrics are. They just take it at face value.
There is a lot of anger in their lyrics.
Yeah, the last couple albums had some bitterness, but it was so many clever turns of phrases. I think they're really hitting on all cylinders for considering they're, you know, guys in their 50s now.
They are.
I've never seen them. Believe it or not.
I think you're right. Even though they are as angry as, say, the Dead Kennedys, they're really funny. So maybe that gets washed away. Adam, I don't know if you have a perspective.
Not in particular. I don't know a super amount about them outside.
Big Lizard in the backyard, like, dude. Big Lizard in my backyard. That I must listen.
Part of the problem is that, like if you're a band and you are a funny band or you're a humorous band, people sometimes don't quite know how to place you. Like, it's one thing to be incredibly angry and sarcastic, and it's another thing to be so goofy that it's like a parody act. But when you're kind of riding that line up the middle where you know you are a genuine band, you're not a joke, but you're doing a lot of stuff that is, you know, that is tongue in cheek and that is funny and that is sarcastic. A lot of people don't know where to put that, and I got to imagine that that's got something.
I think you're absolutely right.
Well,
so
Dead Milkmen have been playing a lot of shows around Philadelphia lately, a lot of smaller shows. So now is definitely the time to check them out. Adam White, I'll let you take this story because this has got Adam White written all over it. Literally, your name is written in the article.
This is more, yeah, more, well, Canadian.
I wrote it, right? Lightfoot. No, you can't, come on. This is industry news, I guess, so it doesn't really have a huge impact on anything right now, but it's pretty interesting for me because it, I don't know, I'll just go through it here. So you got two record labels out of Toronto, maybe probably I would say the biggest independent rock label out of Toronto, at least from a punk news vantage point. And maybe one of the most, I hate to say it because it's in the name, but one of the most buzzed about record labels out of Toronto. And they've announced some sort of merger. And I say some sort of because I don't entirely understand what's going on here. I spoke to someone in a record store recently, and they explained it to me as Dynalone, which is a big label. They've bought some space, they're moving their offices, and this big space that they have is going to kind of allow them to use some of that space to help out other labels. And I guess Buzz, the one they're merging with, is going to be one of these labels that's going to kind of like come in and join the family. And I think it's a little bit more formal than just, you know, them being a tenant of this Dynalone space, that it's actually like some sort of deeper partnership, which is to say that they're co-branding a bunch of events and things like that. So anyways, if you haven't heard of Dynalone Records, they came right out of my area. They're from St. Catharines, Ontario. It was started by a bunch of guys that worked in like a local, like, you know, CD store in the mall when I was in high school. Basically when Alexis on Fire popped up out of Niagara, and then City in Color, Dallas from us, his acoustic solo guy act. That's not quite it. But anyways, that came out at the same time. Dynalone emerged right alongside Alexis on Fire and City on Color, and City in Color, when those things went to prominence. And they've done releases by lots of people, Attack in Black, Badoo and Soundclash. They were the Canadian release, the Canadian label that released the Dirty Nils last record. They're doing the new Flatliners one. And they do a lot of stuff for various US acts now. Like they were, like they released, this is totally random, but the last Marilyn Manson record that came out, like they put out in Canada. So they do a lot of those types of things. Now, Buzz, they have really become, I want to say, one of the most talked about labels lately. They've done stuff by Grays and Adonis Adonis and Weaves and Dilly Dally and HSY. They emerged from the Toronto noise punk scene, the same scene that a band like, say, like Metz came from. Fucked Up kind of lives on the edge of that scene. And they have like done some of the most abrasive and some of the most interesting and rock music to come out of Toronto in the past, I don't know, at least 5 or 6 years. And yeah, really like the hot young upstarts, you know, everyone kind of loves everything that they put out, and everything they put out has been of quality. So these two guys getting together to do something. So, you know, nothing has really been said about any of the upcoming releases outside of the fact that it's, you know, that they haven't changed their plans or anything like that. There's some shows booked, but you know, it's interesting. It's interesting to me. If I go back and I look at like my top 20 lists, it's all like bands from Dine Alone and Buzz. So now it's like I just listen to one label, which is weird.
He's one label kind of guy, ladies. Well, listen, for me, I think this would be like if Alternative Tentacles merged with Alternative Tentacles. So I can understand Adam White's feelings, if you will. He doesn't know what to do. Is it a good thing or a bad? I guess it's a good thing, right, Adam? Or you're not sure?
I imagine it's a good thing. I mean, if Buzz is going to get the resources to keep doing what they're doing, then that's great. The super punk part of me wants to be like, Dine Alone, they're so huge, but like really, it's like
here,
it's
I would say here in the United States, so we're not that blown away by the size of Dine Alone, I don't think.
No, I mean, you know, it's a handful of people, and it's a handful of people that have like been like tirelessly putting out, you know, Canadian music and things like that. So I have no ill word to say about them. So yeah, I don't know.
We might get a word perspective on how big they are, because like you're always talking about them. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know that the average American punk has even heard of Dine Alone, quite frankly.
No, and a lot of the times Dine Alone will like license out something that they're doing in Canada due to a US label, depending on the situation. So like you wouldn't really know in that case. But like a good stat that kind of came out of this was that when they looked at the this is so Canadian, when they looked at the Juno Awards, which were the like the Canadian Grammy things that were just announced, if you went and you said like all the bands that were Dine Alone bands that were involved in that, and all the bands that were Buzz bands that were involved in that, you know, there was a lot of music all of a sudden that's under that one umbrella. So that's, you know, the anti-corporatist part of my brain is like, oh no, consolidation, boo. But
I imagine the Buzz guys are walking out. They're like, well, boys, good job. We're heading over to the Dine Alone offices now. They walk outside and they see somebody slashing their tires. They're like, hey, kids, stop that. And the kid's like, sell out. And they're like, wait, that's not a kid. That guy's 35. And then Adam White goes running down the street.
I know it's bad, but man, there is a show that they've announced that is going to be at CMW, which is a Canadian Music Week. It's like the Canadian version of like South by Southwest that happens up in Toronto every spring. And it's Grays. It's a band from Montreal called Solids. New Swears. New Swears are insane. They're amazing. Sam Coffey and the Iron Lungs, who's on the first Punk News podcast mixtape. Man, I want to go to that show. That looks great. So anyways, Dine Alone and Buzz have some sort of partnership going on, and it affects Adam. I guess.
We're consolidating our two big markets. What's that? Adam White. Like there's a bit, like, what do you call those two circles with the thing in the middle? Or what do you call that?
Venn diagram.
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of the consolidation of things that are interesting to at least one person, there's this guy called Digital Octopus. I'd never heard of this guy before. Adam or Tom, have you heard of this guy, Digital Octopus?
Fortunately, no, I had never heard of him.
He's a French guy, and apparently he's done about 6 or 7 of these. He takes classic punk tracks and reworks them into like an 80s style. There's a Misfits one that sounds a lot like Aha, but it's Misfits Hybrid Moments. There's a whole bunch of them that are like, they sound like Aha or Flock of Seagulls or that kind of thing, but they're punk songs reworked. He just released his latest one, and it's a version of the Cro-Mags' Don't Tread on Me from Age of Quarrel, but it's done in kind of like an electro-funk style, kind of like how Arabian Prince or The Egyptian Lover or World Class Wrecking Crew would do in the early 80s in California, something like that. The two main Cro-Mags both commented on this. One was pissed off and one thought it was hilarious. I'll let you listeners guess which was thought was hilarious, which was pissed off. And it tells you a lot about that particular person. But listen, guys, I actually thought this was like pretty awesome. Like I thought the music itself was like really good, like 80s music. And I think it's kind of funny that it's a Cro-Mag song. I think it shows how strong the underlying song is and how talented this composer is, this guy. I thought this was great.
Ugh, I'm gonna side with Harley Flanagan. I thought this was so pointless. I'm like,
no, Harley thought it was hilarious.
Oh,
he's
the one who thought it was. Oh, I figured it would be the other way around. I figured John.
Jones
would be the one who kind of blew it off. It's so pointless. I would never listen to it. I thought it was sort of like, remember those two women? I can't even remember their names. Who did all those like punk, like loungy versions of punk songs?
You mean Katie Goodman and Greta Morgan?
Yeah, like that. That was awesome. I could kind of get into a little bit, but this was just, I'm just like, no. Dude, that stuff was playing on the radio when I was in grade school. I don't need to have it rehashed for me. So, no thanks.
Adam, get my back on this. Get my back.
This looks like the kind of thing that YouTube was made for, and it probably does not need to exist outside of a YouTube, but... within YouTube, it's just weird enough to be a thing that you'll find on the internet one day.
It seems like just the type of thing that the newly merged Dine Alone and Buzz Records would like to put out, I would think.
That is grossly wrong.
I think this was great. I thought it was hilarious. You should watch, the video itself is funny. We're going to play it right now to cause pain to these two haters. This is Digital Octopus covering the Cro-Mags doing Don't Tread on Me. Digital Octopus, and meanwhile Adam and Tom are treading on me.
Let's talk about Don't Tread on Me is such a great song.
The whole album is a bulletproof album. That's true. Let's talk about some quick news bites, some quick things released. I know Adam White, I know he's going to be down with this one, as I am too. Career Suicide, Machine Response, and I think Tom will like this too. They've released a new album, Machine Response. I thought it was great. Adam White, did you think it was great? And did you think it was Career Suicide doing anything new, or is it just Career Suicide doing what Career Suicide does the best that they can do it?
I feel like there's new here, but it's sort of like in the crush, and I really need to like dig it out. It, for no other reason than this version of Career Suicide is sort of an Adam supergroup. Like it's the drummer from Attack in Black. It's one of the guitar players from the Sadies, and the guitar player from the Sadies that's playing in it, Dallas Good, is like one of these people that is like a bona fide fucking wizard. Like if you go and you like listen to a Sadies record or anything, like he's insane. Like they play this like crazy sped up garage rock bluegrass stuff, like dueling guitars between him and his brother, and it's nuts. And just to know that he is in that mix playing hardcore is sort of mind-blowing to me. But I've not listened to this enough yet where I'm picking it apart and going like, oh, this is a Dallas Good thing that's happening right now, just because it's all like blazing by. But yeah, I'm super excited about it. It's super fun. I'm down. It's gonna be one of my favorite records of the year easily.
I have only listened to it cursorily. I don't know. I've just gone through cursorily? It quick, and I do
cursorily.
You can't script this stuff, boys.
yeah, Jesus.
But I do like it a lot. I'm actually gonna have to go back and listen to it. You know, it's funny because so today is March 1st. I mean, matter. I mean, you kids are gonna be listening to it later on, but today is March 1st. I was looking at like how many albums I've already bought this year. And I swear I already have like 7 albums that I would be entirely comfortable putting on my top 20 year end list.
Last year was strong,
I'm telling you. But the new record by, and it's
no, like, I see, like, I, but
the same as a Career Suicide vein, but a band from Cleveland, that FYPM. I don't want to say their full name because my daughter's behind me. She's wearing headphones, but still. But another tremendously
Tony Yerba band.
Yeah,
Tony
tremendously Yerba good hark. Man, I don't know if you got a chance to listen to that yet, John. It's out in about 3 weeks, but it's tremendously good, too.
Tom, did I send that to you?
I got it.
Yeah. Real good record.
It is really good. And this Career Suicide is a little more, I'd say, a little more polished than that was. A little more, not quite as rough around the edges. But, man, yeah, I dig that Career Suicide album. I'm going to check that out, too. That might be, like, number 8. But yeah, it's going to be the end of the year, and it's going to be like, oh, I have like 42 albums I like.
You know, someone was saying
either that, or they'll be like nothing good after March.
some people were saying, I saw this in a couple of places, that 2017 was going to be the year of hardcore and thrash metal. Do you guys agree?
I'll tell you,
for any particular reason, I think just
last
year happened to have stuff coming out.
Thrash, there was no question about it. You know, Master of Puppets came out in 86. And so it's been like 30 years, and there was a ton of great older bands put out stuff. And this year, Overkill put out a good new album. MOD's got a new album coming out. But this is like the year of newer thrash bands. The Iron Reagan album is unbelievable. You were talking earlier about how it's impossible to be completely objective on a review. I think my first line of the Iron Reagan review was, I'm not going to lie, I love this record, you know, because it's so good. The Power Trip just came out. That's really good. There's some other stuff. There's supposed to be a new Toxic Holocaust album this year, so I gotta agree. Man, so far so good.
Yeah, Adam, to answer your question, people were saying it's going to be the year of hardcore because there's already been a bunch of good hardcore release so far.
And even like
okay, this wasn't one of these dumb. It wasn't like one of these dumb like.
Oh, with Trump in office, everything's going to get angry again.
The
angle
I've been taking is, wow, I'm surprised there's been so much good hardcore released recently, because in these days, hardcore isn't necessarily known for being the most innovative genre, but maybe it is again.
And matter of fact, there's been 2 local hardcore albums. They're, you know, small in scope, Grand Rapids based, that have been, I've been blown away by. Grand Rapids is not really what I call hardcore town in general, but man, there's been a couple of them that have been really good. So, you know, like I said, by March, it might be dry, but man, I'm liking it so far.
Well, speaking of hardcore albums, At The Drive-In have reunited and are releasing a new album. Listen, boys, this guy, he puts out like, literally, he puts out like 5 albums a year, and I don't care about any of them. I mean, I just do not get this band at all. I think it's just boring, meandering, and pointless.
John, I think we found the point on the Venn diagram where you and I cross, our circles cross, because I'm with you.
Man,
I'm with
you on this. I like all of the there's two main guys, Cedric and Omar, and both of their bands just seem so pretentious and pointless.
Volta guy? Is Omar the Mars Volta guy too?
They're both Mars Volta. Both Mars, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, same here. It's just, yeah, not for me.
I'm not trying to be a hater, but man.
But, hold on a sec here. Hold on. Back right up, though. But Omar's in Crystal Fairy. Isn't that one of your bands? I love
Crystal Fairy. But he's
hanging out with Buzz. So, I don't know.
That only proves
maybe it'll rub off on him and help.
That only proves that I truly am a Melvins fan and am able to review them objectively, because just because Buzz likes something doesn't mean that I necessarily like it. I love Crystal Fairy, but Omar by far is the smallest contributor to Crystal Fairy. The biggest contributor are Buzz, Dale, and Terry.
That's how you take that, is that proves that you're objective because you like a band with Buzz in it, even though it's got a guy you don't like. You might have to reevaluate that situation.
At the Drive-In, it's been such a weird band for me. And I mean, here's an interesting corollary to my jukebox theory earlier in the show. I don't like this band. I lump them into that with a lot of, and I'm not calling them this, but like with a lot of the stuff that was in the emo vein in the early 2000s, because so many of the, I feel like so many of the people I knew that were listening to, you know, listening to Thursday and what was those other bands? Taking Back Sunday and Thrice and all those things were also listening to, like, I would say like the Blood Brothers and At the Drive-In, like those types of bands. Right. And I don't quite know how I would lump, put a band like this on my jukebox scale, because on the one hand, I don't like this band. I don't think you would ever put them on a jukebox because people would probably get mad at you, because, I mean, it is sort of shrill and not, you know, singing along with your buds. But I feel like a lot of people experience a band like this with their buds. So I don't quite know how that works. I have a friend of mine that I went to high school with, and I see her every once in a while. And, you know, when, you know, the stars align, we managed to go to a show together, and her husband were like, "Do you want to go see At the Drive-In? They're going to be in Toronto this year." And it's like, huh, what? No, I'm sorry. Like, I love hanging out with you guys, but I don't really want to go do that. But then At the Drive-In canceled because they canceled everything at that point. So, you know, I gotten out. But yeah, I don't know. I don't quite get the appeal. I remember when was a single, One Arm Scissor was getting radio play. And even then, just it would come on the radio, and we I would feel like I feel that this is more academically good than it is, actually good. if that makes any sense, like I totally get that everyone in this band is really good at what they do from a
music teacher standpoint. Like if you've been great at, like, remember, yeah,
absolutely. Like you know, like 9 stars for creativity or whatever, right? Like they're all what's the term I want to look here? They're all savants, right? Everyone in this band is a technical wizard in one way or another, and that's great. But none of the stuff that they put together, none of it makes me happy, and none of it makes me think. It's just I just don't like it. It is abrasive to me.
It seems to be very affected to me, in that like look at these No Wolf Like the Present, Tilting at the Univender, Governed by Contagions, Pendulum in a Peasant's Dress. It seems to be trying very hard. Not that artists shouldn't be trying, but
those are all Blue Oyster Cult songs, right?
they fall into that. Like they're proggy, right? And I totally get why I don't get the Judge prog, because it's pretty antithetical to most of the things that I get into and listen to. But I've never seen like the prog leanings of this band, or I get more overtly of the Mars Volta, the spinoff act, right? I never saw any of those as like endearing qualities. Like when the Mars Volta came out and they started doing this relentlessly pretentious, dumb bullshit, and just like everything about it was just dripping with self-importance.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
And I'm just like, I don't get it. It just doesn't work for me. So I totally get that somewhere there's the Prog News podcast and they're talking about fucking King Crimson most of the time. And, you know, this comes out and they're really super into it. And I don't want to take that away from them. So if you're like a, you know, what's a Prog?
A Progger.
You're a Progger.
I think guy that lives in his mom's basement. Then, I think that's what they're called.
Yeah, like if you like this band, let your freak flag fly.
Speaking of bands that you could say are over self-important or maybe self-important enough, let's talk about the punk version of At the Drive-In or the punk version of Mars Volta, Crusades. Very heavy thematic concept behind the band and the album, and they're streaming the new album. The new album is called This Is Sickness and Sickness Will End. It's out March 7, which will be Friday by the time you hear this on Anxious and Angry. Adam White, why is this band, which is heavily considered, if you will, and not very impulsive, why are you a fan of this band but not the Mars Volta, which is also a heavily considered and not impulsive band?
Well, because when I listen to Crusades, I mean, Crusades is, I mean, in their early stages, were just a pop punk band for the most part. I mean that in a nice way. Like they're playing, you know, three chords punk rock in the same way that so many bands before them have done. There was nothing about what they were trying to do musically that was too out there. Now, they've gotten a little bit harder. There's a little bit more, say, like Propaganda that shines through in this new record than the ones that they had done before that. But like essentially there's still a bunch of guys getting on stage banging out punk rock as you could in your garage. The difference is that Crusades, and this is almost a shtick for them, is that they'll go and they'll find each record will have like this incredibly academic, super obtuse lyrical theme to it, which is always, it's almost like they listen to a bunch of horror punk, right? They listen to your AFIs and your Misfits and your Necromantics and all those kinds of things. And then they decided, you know what? What if we did this, like this spooky, you know, pagan thing, but instead of doing it for like Hollywood horror, we take it from the angle of like a historian doing their thesis about it. And all of their albums are just about like, oh, they're like this record or that this song is about this, you know, heretic from the 14th century that da da da. And they're either super into it or it's being done for, I don't want to say for comedy, but it's almost being done as like a thematic affectation. Like, you know, instead of start singing about, you know, fuck the government or girls, we're going to talk about, you know, medieval heretics. So I don't know. Like, I mean, it never strikes me as offensive to me as say, like, as like a band, like At the Drive-Ins do. Because I get the sense with the Crusades that like, if you're not going to listen to their weird lyrical content, they don't care. Like they're not really doing it for you. They're doing it because that's what they want to do. I always feel like a band like At the Drive-In or the Mars Volta is screaming at me to pay attention to them, and I don't want to. And I think that's sort of the difference. Like I as Crusades' lyrical content is in a way I think very personal in that they care about it. You know,
yeah. At the Drive-In is taking a beat in this episode, I'll tell you.
Things that think they're
cute.
Yeah, not cute, but just things that want me to celebrate Crusades, I don't think Crusades gives a shit if anyone listens to their, you know, historical thesis about 14th century heretics, right? Like, they're just going to do that anyways. I feel that like at the Drive-In, like, deeply cares that people acknowledge.
I feel like
their
at the Drive-In is the kid that has been told every single thing he does is fantastic by his parents. And so when he gets to middle school, he wants you to think everything he does is absolutely fantastic. That's at the Drive-In. Tom Trotter.
I like that we're beating up on a band that I assume will have far more like laudings and riches than we ever will. So it's okay.
It's our revenge. yeah, the Crusades thing, you know, I guess ultimately I sort of want to like them because, you know, they're not singing about girls and friendship and whiskey and growing beards and things. I kind of enjoy the lyrical aspect of it, I guess, but ultimately they sound too much like Rise Against me or something. It's not necessarily for me. I mean, whatever, people like them. I don't want to piss on them.
I will commend them for being daring and doing something unique with their music. And
there's nothing unique and daring with the music, the lyrics.
The lyrics, the theme, man, the package.
I know what you meant. But no, same thing. You know, I don't dislike them. I don't want to speak badly of them. I don't know that they'll be my favorite band, but I don't know. I think it's at least sort of interesting.
Well, speaking of interesting things, Tom Trauma, play a song that you think is interesting.
Okay, I'm gonna play.
What if Tom was like, "Oh yeah, I'll get right to that," and meanwhile he's like scraping his "At the Drive-In" track under the rug,
like have some pop punk thing. And you know, I tend to speak poorly about a lot of pop punk stuff, and I don't really regret that. But I really enjoy pop punk when it's done well. I just think that, and a lot of people say, "Oh, we're in a new golden era of pop punk." I don't hear it. It's too wimpy for me. Too much pop and not enough punk. But anyway, I hope there's a good pop punk album this year. I don't think there was one that really blew me away last year, but maybe like a new Copyrights album or something. But anyway, I'm going to play a song by a new sort of hardcore, tongue-in-cheek hardcore group from Grand Rapids. They are four or five guys at the moment, I'm not sure, but they like all sing and they all play guitar. So there's lots of guitars and lots of singing and lots of stuff going on. And the band is called West Side Rebellion. They just put out their first EP and it's called EP, which is not that great of a name for an EP, but still. And I'm going to play the first song from that, which is called Fist Fight. And I really dig these guys. West Side Rebellion. The song is called Fist Fight.
And that was West Side Rebellion doing Fist Fight. If we recall, the band Titus Andronicus had that great song Food Fight, which I love. Anyways, Tom Trauma, thanks for bringing the hardcore. Thanks for bringing the tongue-in-cheekness. Thanks for bringing the Mars Voltage love.
I try, guys. It's been fun as always.
And Adam White, thank you once again for your insight, and we shall ponder what it is for a punk rock band to be in the jukebox or out of the jukebox, and what does that mean?
As long as it came from the shower, it's good shit. I do a lot of my best thinking shit. In the
shower, I admit it.
You mean best drinking. Whatever.
You know, I don't. I have a bald head, so I don't have to waste all that time shampooing and conditioning like you guys. It gives me more time to, you know, just soak in the warm water and really contemplate life and its many intricacies. Are we done? That's where we're at.
Yeah, no, okay.